From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the democratization of Poland. We talk with New York Times reporter John Darnton about his first trip back to Poland since 1982, the year he won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the rise of Solidarity and the imposition of martial law. The UN Truth Commission holds El Salvador's military responsible for most of the human rights abuses during that country's civil war. Declassified documents in the United States indicate that American officials covered up their knowledge of those abuses. We'll talk with Tom Blanton of the National Security Archive. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Wynton Marsalis' new album. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton got a first-hand report from Russian Foreign Minister Andrei Kozyrev today about Russia's economic woes and promised again to try to help. He said assisting Russia would save Americans billions of dollars that would otherwise go into maintaining a nuclear arsenal. Barry Schwide reports.
With a squeeze on the budget and the deficit projected at $332 billion, boosting aid to Russia will take some salesmanship. And the president is beginning to pitch hard. Totally committed to the political survival of Boris Yeltsin, and due to see him at the summit in 11 days, the president is making the point that if reformers are replaced by hardliners and the arms race is revived, it would cost American taxpayers billions of dollars. By contrast, his argument goes, aiding Russia with Yeltsin in power is a bargain. But some members of Congress are hearing from home that foreign aid isn't popular. Russian Foreign Minister Andrei Kozyrev knows that, and so U.S. aid may take more of a form of cooperation in joint projects and rescheduling debt rather than large direct outlays. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Diplomats at the United Nations said today that the political crisis in Russia has forced the Security Council to postpone a vote on military enforcement of the no-fly zone over Bosnia. Wire service reports quoted diplomats as saying that a vote on the issue could add to the crisis because Russians are culturally aligned with the Serbs. Bosnia's president, Aliha Izetbegovic, charged that the international community had once again failed to take steps to ensure peace in his country. At the UN, the peace talks aimed at ending the conflict in Bosnia appear deadlocked. And today, Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic said that he'll probably leave New York tonight. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports from the UN.
Karadzic told reporters that in its current form, the peace plan drawn up by international negotiators Cyrus Vance and Lord Owen is unacceptable. He said it deprived the Bosnian Serb population of a common border. Lord Owen charges that Karadzic's proposals would effectively mean the destruction of Bosnia. Owen told reporters that for the moment, the gulf separating Karadzic from the Bosnian Muslims and Croats is too wide to bridge.
I don't think it is possible to reconcile them by just plain negotiations. No, I think it has to require a lot more diplomatic, economic, and maybe military pressure.
Owen did not say what type of military pressure he envisions. For the time being, negotiators are hoping they can get the Muslim-led Bosnian government to back the plan. This would then isolate Karadzic and clear the way for a concerted pressure campaign. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials lost more than 16 points. This is NPR News. Federal authorities have escorted another suspect in the World Trade Center bombing back to the United States. Mahmoud Abu Halima was arrested by Egyptian authorities last week and turned over to U.S. officials. Abu Halima, who formerly worked as a cab driver in New Jersey, was identified by the FBI as a key figure in the bombing that took six lives and injured more than 1,000 people. One of the most notorious of El Salvador's right-wing death squads has reemerged, publishing threats against political opponents and international organizations it claims are damaging the country's sovereignty. The complaints are part of an outspoken campaign against the UN-appointed Truth Commission, which published its findings on civil war crimes last week. Tom Gibb reports from San Salvador.
The secret anti-communist army threatened, among others, the United States Embassy, the United Nations, leftist rebels, and military officers who negotiated the peace accords. While it's unclear whether this is just propaganda, the threat coincides with a general campaign by the right wing to prevent the implementation of the Truth Commission recommendations. Last night, the entire high command went on television to dismiss the report as unjust, incomplete, biased, and insolent. President Alfredo Cristiani has already said there's no constitutional way he can replace the Supreme Court, as the commission recommended. As yet, he's not said whether he'll remove 40 army officers named for abuses. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
An effort to evacuate refugees from the Bosnian city of Srebrenica was halted today after Serbian troops shelled some of the refugees as they waited to be airlifted to safety. The attack came as UN peacekeepers tried to ferry people out of the city by helicopter. Officials said the Serbian attack killed one and injured 21, including two Canadian peacekeepers. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Darton remembers leaving Poland with the smell of tear gas in the air. Martial law had been in effect for 9 months. Lech Wałęsa was under house arrest. Thousands of union and labor leaders were in jail or underground. The year was 1982, Darton's third and final year covering Poland for the New York Times. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of the rise of Solidarity and the imposition of martial law. Now Darton is the New York Times London bureau chief. Last month, he returned to Poland. He spent 3 weeks investigating life after communism in the country that's been called the success story of Eastern Europe. As soon as his plane landed in Poland, he was amazed by how much things had changed.
First of all, the plane led directly into the terminal, which was unusual. Before, there was an older airport, and you sort of got on a bus, which drove kicking fumes right up to the airport, and you had to get out, stand in a long line, waiting for the immigration and customs officials to search you. They almost always did. The immigration official used to have a mirror up above the people in the line that he could check from time to time. I never quite knew what he was looking for in the mirror. He could only see the tops of the heads. Then he would look through your passport very leisurely, checking every page, skeptically, seeing where you've been, checking your name on lists and probably on computers, and then finally, reluctantly grant you a stamp to enter the country. And you'd have to go through the whole process again with the baggage officials, and it took forever. This time I arrived in a spanking new airport. The immigration officials just basically waved me and everyone else through, looking at the American passport very, very quickly. And there were signs in English and loudspeakers booming, everything functioning perfectly, and it was all very smooth. So you get hit by the changes even before you technically set foot inside the country.
And what about when you set foot inside the country? What had changed?
Well, almost on the surface, of course, everything, because there are billboards all over the place on the ride in from the airport, billboards with, women in bathing suits drinking Coca-Cola, billboards for Marlboro, for all kinds of products, car lots on both sides of the street selling Fords and all sorts of vehicles that weren't in the country before. Even car lots downtown selling Mercedes and Alfa Romeos. I was struck by things that I did not see, namely the long lines. There used to be these incredible lines in front of the stores snaking all the way down the streets. And you would think that would lend a kind of life to the street to have all those people there, but it didn't. It was a kind of static situation before. Now there were crowds, and they were kind of bustling about. It looked like everyone's in a hurry. You imagine they're all, on their way to an appointment somewhere, probably to hatch some kind of business deal. There are a lot of shops out on the streets and new boutiques, Christian Dior and major Western outlets have opened up. So the whole city has a different kind of look and a different feel to it.
These new boutiques, can anybody in Poland afford to buy things in them?
You have touched the problem right there. Before, 11, 12, 13 years ago, they had shoddy stores with very little merchandise, and everyone had a lot of money, zlotys, almost worthless money that was non-convertible. Now they have these wonderful stores overflowing with all kinds of goods, VCRs and Western imports and everything else. But of course, the people don't have the money to buy them. I don't know which is better. Polls would say, many of them, it's better to at least have the opportunity to work for the goods. I think it probably causes, in the long run, less discontent because it tends to make people want to work more.
Did you see a new kind of poverty in Poland?
Yes, absolutely. It's not highly visible, and it's still not comparable to what you might see walking across town in New York. But they do have, for the first time, soup kitchens opening up, usually in the bowels of railroad stations somewhere. There's one in Katowice. There's one at the central station in Warsaw, although it's just closed down. They have special restaurants where people can obtain vouchers and hand them in to get meals for about 1,000 or 10,000 zlotys, which is a paltry amount. Those who are most affected tend to be pensioners, people living on fixed incomes who've been wiped out by inflation, which was rampant for years now, and people who live in small towns that are dependent on single industries, say an industry which used to make armaments for the Warsaw Pact. And these people are indeed suffering, but you don't see them right away, and you don't see them walking through the center of Warsaw.
Are the poor suffering any more now than they were under communism?
Oh, that's a difficult question to answer, but I think there's certainly the conviction that they are. Before, there was, don't forget, this whole system in place to catch people if they were on the very bottom so that they couldn't actually hit the hard ground if they were falling. There were systems, guaranteed employment, of course, ranking first among them, but systems of social support, all kinds of things, all kinds of benefits, stores where the price of meat and the price of bread and the price of milk and the price of everything else was subsidized so that it was kept low, and all kinds of benefits for workers in terms of vacations and books for their school children and a kind of a swaddling clothing from the cradle to the grave. Now, it wasn't a good system in the sense that it wasn't efficient, and it certainly didn't encourage production or even creativity, and we all know what it led to. But probably from the sense of feeling secure in the world, it certainly beats what they had right now, although I don't think many Poles, in fact, I doubt any Poles, none I talk to, would want to return to it.
Last week, the Polish parliament rejected a bill to privatize industries. Do you think that this means a setback for Poland's advance into a market economy?
Well, personally, yes, I do. Although just in the last day, in fact, yesterday, it's made clear that the government is going to resubmit the bill, changing it somewhat, but basically keeping it's the core of it. To try and get it through Parliament again. And I think ultimately in some form it will pass. I think it's important because, like most of the countries of Eastern Europe, Poland has still not solved the basic dilemma of what to do with all these state-owned companies that were so inefficient, how to get them to convert quickly to private companies. They've been doing it up to now on a piecemeal basis, one by one, persuading Western companies to come in and take a look and make a bid for this company. That's a long and rather clumsy process. So Poland has fallen far behind in terms of privatizing companies. Of some 3,500 companies, I think only a handful have been really privatized, and only about 16 are in the new Warsaw Stock Exchange. So the intent of this bill was to take 600 of the best companies, although not the largest, and at one fell swoop to privatize them all under a complicated system that would basically have them managed by trusts in the hands of Western experts so that they could turn into profit-making efficient enterprises.
Why do some people oppose this bill that would have privatized many industries?
You know, that's a really interesting and difficult question. whenever I asked it, I got different answers, and I began to think there was something very basic going on that was eluding me, something that often happens, I'm afraid. But in this case, what had happened, I think, was a growing, almost unstated sense on the part of a lot of workers that that privatization can represent a threat. First of all, there is the threat of unemployment, because when factories are taken over by Western interests, there are often layoffs. The workers are aware of it. It comes as no surprise. They're often warned about it, but it's deemed as a necessary evil to, to strip the company down and turn it into a kind of forceful creative enterprise. But more than that, I think the workers had a strange sense that somehow the factories were not fetching the proper prices. Don't forget, for years they had worked there. Some cases their parents and grandparents have worked there. And there is a sense that these companies have been gaining in value over time rather than losing in value, because there's no concept of what a Westerner would call depreciation. They thought all that huge machinery and all those thick walls of those textile mills were worth billions and billions. And when they were up for sale, they simply couldn't understand, one, that nobody was interested, or two, that they would only be willing to pay, several score millions of dollars. And that's given rise to a kind of an undercurrent of anxiety, in a sense, maybe, that outside interests are profiting, who knows who they are, the sort of dark side of Polish history, where there are unseen forces at work that are somehow taking advantage of the honest working person.
Do you think of Poland as the success story of the countries that broke away from the Soviet Union?
Well, I do, and I'm not alone in that. If you look at the statistics, the economy seems to have turned a corner and done so only very recently. Hungary and the Czech Republic, of course, are both doing fairly well, but they are really altogether different animals. They're much smaller. It's not comparable in just population or industrial output to Poland. Poland is a large, powerful country, and if it can do it, then it's a real lesson for Russia and other countries. And just in the last quarter of the last year, suddenly, Poland, which was the first country to adopt what they call shock therapy, suddenly removing all the subsidies and making the zloty convertible, Poland seems to have suddenly started performing. Its GNP went up, which is amazing. It'll probably be the first country in the area to really do that. And more significantly, its industrial output went up for the first time after a deep plunge that lasted for years. So there are those who think it's turned a corner, and if it can, say, pass the privatization bill, it would really take off.
My guest is New York Times reporter John Darton. He returned to Poland last month. He reported from Poland for The Times from 1979 to 82. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is New York Times reporter John Darton. Poland doesn't seem to have been torn apart by the ethnic divisions that have torn apart so many other countries that were with the Soviet Union.
Well, that again, you've touched a key feature of the country. Poland, for a variety of reasons, which we all know very well, happens to be totally homogeneous right now. Its boundaries have shifted, of course, from their pre-war state several hundred miles to the west. There is no large ethnic minority of any sort, including, of course, Jews. It does not have sizable minorities from any of the neighboring countries. There are some Germans in one area. There are illegal Russians crossing the border all the time. But basically, it is 97% Catholic, white, Polish.
Well, let's talk about the Catholic Church. When you were in Poland reporting for the New York Times from 79 to 82, the Catholic Church was a very important meeting and organizing place for the underground. What's the role of the Catholic Church in Polish society now?
Oh, it has changed markedly, and that is something that strikes you as soon as you enter the country. Back in 79 and 80 and 81, the church, which in Polish history has been the repository of sort of Polish nationalism and Polish identity, served primarily as a form of opposition to the communists. It's a role it had become very comfortable with under many various communist leaders, and it was almost a patriotic duty to go to church to express your opposition to the communists. The church, in other words, had a tremendous drawing power. On Sundays, masses were packed. The whole very, very few Poles would admit to being unbelievers unless, of course, they were in the government. And Cardinal Wyszyński, who was then primate, exerted a tremendous influence over the daily life of many Poles. Now, today, it's interesting that with the Communist Party gone, the Roman Catholic Church is probably the single most powerful institution in the country.
Poland is a Catholic country, but do Catholics in Poland want the church exerting this much influence over their cultural and political lives?
I think not. I have heard over and over that they did not. And in fact, it was the situation that existed before was this kind of interesting stalemate in which everyone benefited. People often disobeyed the moral strictures of the church and then went to confession for absolution. But the means, if a woman wanted an abortion, the means of getting an abortion was quite easy. It was all state done. It could be done very quickly, and there were no problems. And then she would often go to the church and confess. And the confession, of course, would be received. Now it's much, much more complicated because it's extremely hard to get an abortion, and the church, of course, fought hard to make it so and will continue fighting to make it even harder. So I think the role of the church in daily life is much stronger than it was in the past in a strange way, even though you now notice fewer people going to church and a decline in vocations, say, fewer people entering the priesthood. So the grip of the church on the kind of the moral conscience of the people has been loosened to some extent, even while its political grip, I think, has been strengthened.
When you were in Poland, I'm sure a lot of the dissidents were some of your most important sources. Did you go back and revisit some of those people and see how they like the new Poland?
I did, yes. And they're all doing very well in the new Poland, or at least many of them. A surprising number of people have been elected to parliament, people who I just remember as being sort of ragamuffins meeting on street corners just as they were let out of jail cells. It's a kind of shock to go back and see someone who you knew as a solidarity leader and a very articulate man, but basically a man totally outside the system, to see him as the Minister of Defense in his office with a crossed swords over a tapestry and these stern portraits on the wall, to go in and suddenly you're hugged by the Minister of Defense, who says, "I can't quite believe it either." And he described how difficult it was to convince the army that he wasn't really going to purge them from top to bottom. And he said, "We didn't really have much to do with the army. We knew the police quite well because they arrested us all the time, but we didn't know much about the army." That's surprising to see that.
Did you visit any of the former communist officials who you knew in the 70s and 80s when you were in Poland?
I did, yes. In fact, a lot of them now have considerable amount of time on their hands, so it was very easy to speak with them.
Were they doing well? Were they prospering in the new society? Or?
No. They looked a bit. Perhaps it was my own imagination, but they looked quite a bit older. Some of them, none of them seem to be actually suffering. They have pensions, but it's pretty hard to find a communist in Poland these days. Someone who will admit to being a communist. One friend of mine said it was a bit like finding a Nazi in post-war Germany. They've just all gone. Some of them have converted and are actually sort of working with the new parliament. Others are out of a job but writing their memoirs. General Jaruzelski is working on a book. I interviewed him, and he seemed contrite about martial law at the same time that he was still justifying the necessity of it. The very contemplative, apologetic, unlike, of course, Moscow today, where there is a hardcore element that seems to be trying to turn the great ship around. The Poles now realize that they were cruising in the wrong waters, and they're looking back and sort of wondering if it could have been different.
Is there any fear in Poland that if the communists reasserted their control in Moscow, that there would be danger in Poland?
There is, but not for the reason you might think. The idea of a return to communism in Poland is unthinkable. Unlike Moscow, as an ideology, there was always the sense that it was imposed from the outside. In fact, Stalin himself once said that communism fits Poland the way a saddle fits a cow. It just never took root there. As many people know, agriculture was never communalized. It remained in private hands, and religion was always strong, and Poland is almost the only country that never constructed a statue to Stalin. So communism never sank deep roots in Poland in the same way that it did, say, next door. And I don't think it could ever come back. What Poles now worry about in their dark moments is that there will be tremendous upheaval to the east, not just in Russia, but in Ukraine or Belarus,
places on Poland's border.
Exactly. And what they'll be faced with is an influx of refugees, especially if their border to Germany, the Polish border to Germany, is cut off, that could cause them problems.
Is there anything you'd want to add to how you think changes there might affect Poland?
Well, they're bound to. All along, when I look back now, when I left Poland back in 82, I couldn't conceive of what would happen. I knew there was massive discontent in the country, and I thought it might bubble up at some point, and there'd be perhaps even an insurrection that would be put down with force. I never could have conceived that it would be Moscow that would have changed and that would have caused all the changes in the so-called satellite countries. So this time, I am convinced we have to watch Moscow very, very closely, because obviously it couldn't reestablish its rule in the same way over Poland and Hungary and Czech and the Slovak Republic. But it certainly, if it becomes a center of chaos or anarchy, will affect their lives immeasurably.
John Darton, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
John Darton received a 1982 Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of Poland. He's now the New York Times London bureau chief. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Last week, the UN released a report on human rights abuses during the civil war in El Salvador. The report holds the Salvadoran military responsible for the murders of Archbishop Romero, 4 American women church workers, 6 Jesuits, and the massacre of civilians. Declassified American documents show that American officials covered up what they knew about those crimes. Coming up, we talk with Tom Blanton of the National Security Archive, the group that got the documents released through the Freedom of Information Act. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Wynton Marsalis' new album. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton met today with Russian Foreign Minister Andrei Kozarev at the White House in order to lay the groundwork for next week's summit meeting in Vancouver. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Clinton and Kozarev discussed the turmoil in Russia, the upcoming summit meeting between Clinton and Boris Yeltsin, and the outlines of a U.S. aid package to Russia. At the beginning of the meeting, Clinton sought again to convince the American public that a bigger investment in aid would be worth it. It will be billions of dollars in money we don't have to spend maintaining a nuclear arsenal, the president said. And Kozarev, too, was anxious to convince the American public. He told reporters that support for reform will pay off in the form of more American jobs. Kozarev and Clinton discussed a number of aid projects, including technical assistance programs and a rescheduling of Russia's foreign debt. In addition, President Clinton spoke by phone to Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney and British Prime Minister John Major today. They talked about what the G7 nations and international institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund could do to help. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Croatia has called on the U.S. for some $26 million in aid to help pay for some 275,000 people who have fled the fighting in Bosnia. According to Croatian radio reports, the prime minister has written Secretary of State Warren Christopher saying that medical treatment for homeless Bosnians might have to be limited if more money is not made available. He said that his country has offered more aid to Bosnians than any other nation, despite virtual economic collapse and continued Serbian occupation. An air evacuation of wounded civilians from a besieged area of eastern Bosnia had to be suspended today after Serbian forces shelled a soccer field that was being used as a landing zone for UN helicopters. NPR's Tom Jelton reports from Belgrade.
The Srebrenica evacuation was to be carried out under terms agreed to formally by the Bosnian Serb leadership, but the agreement was violated before the operation even began, with Serb forces shelling Srebrenica this morning in spite of a promised ceasefire. 4 French helicopters were then detained by Serb forces at an airfield in Zvornik, again in violation of the agreement. Eventually, 3 were permitted to fly on to Srebrenica, and they evacuated 21 wounded civilians. But as soon as the helicopters took off, the Serbs bombarded the helicopter landing zone. 2 Canadian peacekeepers assisting in the evacuation were wounded, 1 critically. A senior British officer at the UN Bosnian Command said the Serb shelling of the landing zone was the ultimate in despicable behavior. I'm Tom Jelton in Belgrade.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 16 points to close at 3,445.38 on volume of more than 272 million shares. Trading today was heavy. This is NPR News. Testifying today on Capitol Hill, Federal Reserve Board Chairman Alan Greenspan said that he believes that faster job growth will occur soon, but not enough to bring down unemployment at a pace with which he is comfortable. Appearing before the Senate Finance Committee, Greenspan termed the current 7% unemployment rate too high, and he called on Congress and the White House to work on the nation's budget deficit. Greenspan said this could lead to a drop in long-term interest rates and a higher standard of living. The House is considering a measure to reauthorize funding for federally funded family planning clinics. The measure would also write into law President Clinton's action, lifting the gag rule, banning abortion counseling at federally funded clinics. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Under the measure being debated by the House, the nation's 4,000 federally funded family planning clinics would receive $238 million. Perhaps just as significant, it would make law President Clinton's executive order lifting the Bush administration's gag rule. Freshman Democrat Carolyn Maloney of New York spoke in favor of the measure.
No one in this country, least of all pregnant women, should be limited by their government in the kind of information they can receive from their doctor.
Republicans plan to offer a number of amendments to the measure, restricting availability of abortions. A floor vote is expected tomorrow. Both the House and Senate will vote later in the year on a measure writing into law a woman's right to an abortion, approved today by a Senate panel. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
In the southeast, flooding has closed schools and roads. High waters have occurred because of melting snow and heavy rain that in the west have caused mudslides and flooding. In East Tennessee, several hundred people were forced out of their homes yesterday by flooding, but most were allowed back today. Snowfall in New Hampshire caused a loss of power to thousands of homes and closed schools in that state in a number of places. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The UN Commission on the Truth in El Salvador issued its report last week on human rights abuses during that country's 12-year civil war. The commission found that the Salvadoran military was responsible for the overwhelming majority of human rights abuses, including the murders of Archbishop Romero, four American women church workers, and six Jesuits, as well as the massacre of peasants. The Salvadoran military received financial aid and training from the United States. Congress passed a law that before aid could be approved, the Reagan administration had to demonstrate to Congress every 6 months that El Salvador was improving its human rights record. Recently declassified documents indicate that the Reagan and Bush administrations covered up what they knew about the military's involvement in assassinations, murders, and massacres. The documents were obtained by the National Security Archive through the Freedom of Information Act. Many of these documents were used by the Truth Commission. My guest Tom Blanton is the executive director of the archive. He says American officials should be held accountable for their cover-ups. The full truth is not yet known, he says, because many of the released documents have extensive passages that are blacked out.
I have in my hand here a 1984 Central Intelligence Agency document. It's the 2nd of March, 1984. It's from the Directorate of Intelligence. The headline is El Salvador Terrorist Activities, and on page 3, there's a subhead titled Assassination of Archbishop Romero. Everything underneath that subhead is blacked out.
The official reason for blacking something out is to protect national security?
That's what they say, and out to the side of this censorship, there's a little note that says B1, and that's the specific exemption under the Freedom of Information Act that says we have to protect national security. Well, my fundamental analysis of a document like this is what's really being protected are those American officials who went up on Capitol Hill and went on national television and said, oh, we don't really know who killed Archbishop Romero and, you know, might even have been the guerrillas, and it sure wasn't any of our folks.
Let's look at the big picture first before we get to some of the specific massacres and assassinations that the Truth Commission investigated. Looking at the big picture, what kind of evidence have you uncovered that the government in the United States knew that the El Salvador military was behind assassinations, disappearances, torture, and other human rights abuses?
There's a fundamental document called the Werner Report, which a special study group sent by the Pentagon to El Salvador in 1981 put together, and it really was the key strategy document for the whole American effort to fight the war in El Salvador. And back in 1983 and 84, a whole series of different journalists asked for this document under the Freedom of Information Act and were denied the document. Basically, the American government said, hey, national security, you can't have this. It would embarrass our Salvadoran partners. It would give away our strategy. It would damage American national security. Well, in January of this year, the Pentagon finally released it. One of our analysts at the National Security Archive, Kate Doyle, had just kept following up. The key thing about this document is that it shows the Pentagon was well aware that there was no accountability in El Salvador, that the Army was working with impunity killing civilians, that in fact they were not subject to the justice system, and yet the Pentagon was recommending massive investment in the Salvadoran military to win the war. I think one of the most interesting things, this document was completed, I think the end of this mission was November 1981, and less than 4 weeks later was the El Mazote massacre perpetrated by one of the key battalions that was a key part of this whole strategy.
The Truth Commission report that found that the right-wing leader Roberto D'Aubuisson had ordered the assassination of Archbishop Romero, who was a critic of the government, and that one army captain and one former army captain played an active role in the assassination. Do any of your declassified documents indicate anything that United States officials might have known and withheld about that?
Absolutely. The murder of Archbishop Romero was the defining event in El Salvador in many respects. He was a real martyr. The fact that even the church, the head of the church, was not exempt from death squad activities. It was a real turning point, I think, in the polarization and the Civil War. And the Reagan administration over and over during the 1980s denied that it had any real evidence connecting the right-wing leader D'Aubuisson to the shooting of the archbishop. In 1984, for example, the State Department wrote to members of Congress that the information they had was limited and incomplete, and, quote, we have received other intelligence reports on the Romero assassination which contradict the charges that D'Aubuisson, for example, was involved. But now we've got a declassified document, a cable from the embassy in December 1981, which is, while heavily deleted, has an extraordinary story of, let me just quote from this document, because it's a scene that is just very striking and chilling in many respects. That the top of the cable, the first three lines are blacked out. Then it says, a meeting chaired by Major Roberto D'Aubuisson, during which the murder of Archbishop Romero was planned. Then another deletion. Then, during the meeting, some of the participants drew lots for the privilege of killing the archbishop. Big deletion. Then, assassin as Walter, deletion. Identified, deletion, deletion. Then, Walter as Walter Antonio Alvarez, and then a big deletion, and then a final sentence. According to press reports, several gunmen took Alvarez away from a football game on September 27th, shot him several times, and left his body on the road which leads to Mariona Prison. He was 27 years old and left his wife, Denora, and a small son. Big deletion. Then a final sentence, we believe it is highly likely that the assassin of Romero is now dead by unknown hands. Now, let me just recap this little cable. It says there was a meeting. D'Aubuisson chaired it. The people there drew lots for the privilege of killing the archbishop. Whoever the sources were to the U.S., who told the U.S. Embassy this story, they went on to identify specifically the gunman, the guy who pulled the trigger, presumably the guy who followed up this meeting with D'Aubuisson by shooting the archbishop, and then go on to say that the embassy knew that this guy had himself been killed. The embassy knew this, the State Department knew this in December 1981, and yet in 1984 was telling the Congress, oh, we've got incomplete and limited information. We've got intelligence reports that contradict whether D'Aubuisson was involved.
Who was this cable from?
This was from the embassy in San Salvador, signed by Dean Hinton, who was Reagan's appointee as ambassador to El Salvador, to the Secretary of State in Washington.
How did you get your hands on this?
It was declassified through the Freedom of Information Act. And as I said, it's heavily deleted. One of the reasons we believe that it was declassified was because the former ambassador, the Carter appointee, Robert White, had been coming forward to congressional committees saying, look, the State Department has evidence in its files about who ordered these killings, who ordered the murders of the churchwomen, who ordered the killing of Romero. And so the State Department and the government released some of this under the Freedom of Information Act under that kind of pressure.
My guest is Tom Blanton, Executive Director of the National Security Archive, which uses the Freedom of Information Act to get access to classified documents. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Blanton, Executive Director of the National Security Archives. Actually, I think you have a declassified cable from former Ambassador Robert White, a cable to then-Secretary of State Alexander Haig about the murder in El Salvador of four American churchwomen in 1980.
That's exactly right, where Alexander Haig, when he was appointed Secretary of State very early on, tried to say, ooh, those churchwomen, you know, maybe they ran a roadblock or there was an exchange of fire. I mean, this is a ludicrous concept of, you know, nuns with weapons who are shooting back at a roadblock. And in light of what we now know happened and how the Truth Commission describes what happened to those churchwomen, it's worse than ludicrous. It's such a perversion of the truth. It had to have the effect. I mean, think about it this way. If you're in the National Guard or in the Army in El Salvador, and you've just wiped out a group of churchwomen, and the world is condemning this action, and the Secretary of State of the United States gets up in front of Congress and on nationwide TV and says, oh, well, you know, we have some information that maybe those nuns were running the roadblock and maybe there was an exchange of fire. You can just imagine the impact of that, telling those guys that they can get away with this kind of thing.
So what did the cable from Ambassador White say?
Ambassador White cabled back to the Secretary of State after Haig and others were saying that the Salvadoran government was seriously investigating the murder of the churchwomen. And White said, basically, you gotta be kidding. I'm here, and I'm telling you there's no serious investigation of these murders. In fact, what we now know from the Truth Commission report is that the head of the National Guard, Colonel Vitas Casanova, helped cover up those murders and later, with the recommendation of the U.S. government, was promoted to be defense minister.
The Truth Commission asked for the immediate removal from the El Salvador military of all officers cited for human rights violations. You're concerned about the accountability of American officials who lied to Congress and to the American public. What kind of efforts are afoot in Congress now to investigate cover-ups in the American government?
Well, right now, a subcommittee of the House Foreign Affairs Committee has taken on the task of what they call reviewing every word of the Reagan administration related to El Salvador in light of these new documents, in light of the Truth Commission report.
What are you going to try to do to get more information released from the government? I know you want the government to declassify more documents and also to release information that has been blacked out of documents that you've already gotten released.
What we're going to do is go through the enormous collection of documents that many journalists and many researchers and our own staff have put together over almost a decade, figure out the key documents that are still censored by the government, put together those lists, give them to people in Congress, give them to people in the State Department, and basically say, here, if you want to restore trust in government, if you want to get out the full story, if you want to rise to the standard set by the Truth Commission, this is what you need to release. You need to go back and look at these key violations, the massacre at Mazote, the killing of the churchwomen, the assassination of Archbishop Romero, the murders of the Jesuits, and so forth. And genuinely make public the information that you had so that we all know the full story, so that we hold our own government accountable. It's not only for history, it's for responsibility, it's for accountability.
Do you think that a Democratic administration is more likely to release the documents that you want declassified because the people who it would reveal information about were working under Republican administrations? Does it work that way?
I think partly it works that way, but The reality here is the Carter administration is not going to come off real well in this process either.
Mm-hmm.
Right after the church women were killed, for example, the Carter administration cut off military aid. But as soon as the guerrillas launched their offensive in January of 1981, the Carter administration sent more aid. Now, you know, that kind of response is not calculated to instill in the Salvadoran military respect for human rights. But politically speaking, I think that the Clinton administration, not only on El Salvador, but on a variety of issues now that the Cold War is over, has an opportunity to change the whole secrecy system. And I think they're going to have to, if only to save the money. It costs so much to keep all these secrets. And I think that it's going to be in their interest to follow up the Truth Commission's kind of effort, make all this stuff public.
Tom Blanton, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Tom Blanton is the executive director of the National Security Archive in Washington, D.C. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have from Bosnia?
Well, we'll hear from Tom Jelton today on the aborted evacuation from Srebrenica, the besieged Muslim city in eastern Bosnia. Also, Noah Adams talks with a spokesman for the United Nations who defends the diplomacy of Cyrus Vance and Lord Owen against criticism that it's actually providing a cover for further fighting in Bosnia. We'll also be hearing today about the arrest of another suspect in the World Trade Center bombing. He's been flown from Egypt to New York today. And also remembering John Hersey, the author of Hiroshima, who died today.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Wynton Marsalis thrives on outside inspiration. Early on, Miles Davis's trumpet and quintet styles were Marsalis's guiding influence. Later, as he became more involved with composing, he patterned his sound after Duke Ellington's. A couple of recent works were inspired by visual stimuli, dance pieces by modern choreographers. Kevin says he likes these compositions to a point.
The music Wynton Marsalis has written for choreographers Peter Martins and Garth Fagan are the composer's most interesting and radical works yet, even if they are steeped in 1920s music, from New Orleans jazz to Stravinsky. Marsalis's score for Fagan's 1991 dance Griot New York is now out on two CDs under the title City Movement. As reviewers have pointed out, some parts are reminiscent of cartoon music, as distinct textures and motifs roll by. Whether you're composing for ballet or the Roadrunner, what makes sense when linked to movement will sound abstract when heard blind. That's what makes the music sound hip and modern. At times, City Movement sounds indebted to the rediscovered Raymond Scott, whose music turned up in a lot of cartoons. With City Movement, Wynton Marsalis has become much more comfortable working with extended forms, achieving unity by frequent reshuffling of basic themes and motifs. And like Duke Ellington, or Barry Manilow, he's not about milking a melodic hook. Marsalis's eternal problem is he's addicted to mimicking other people's styles, reeling them off one after another. A Cuban rumba, some modal Coltrane, a Mingus Moan for vocal chorus, and the best Ellington impersonations around. since lots of critics do handstands, even for Winton's mediocre records, they're doing backflips for this one. And I think a couple of my colleagues strain themselves. Both the New York Times' Peter Watrous and liner note writer Stanley Crouch sort of acknowledge Winton's borrowing from the same avant-garde types he trashes in interviews. But somehow, Winton gets all the credit, and the people he copies get the brush off. Since Marcellus is a stickler for historical perspective, let's remember that the Art Ensemble of Chicago knew about the infinite flexibility of the blues, the beauty of plunger-muted trumpet, and the value of early jazz long before Marcellus caught on. Or that his jumpy mixing of genres follows John Zorn's by almost a decade. Or that Mujal Richard Abrams and Henry Threadgill were combining different jazz dialects into fresh amalgams of old and new around when Winton started shaving. None of these pioneering musicians were acknowledged in Stanley Crouch's liner notes. Marcellus also faces danger asking his young musicians to play early jazz styles straight. Once a music's time has passed, it's not easy to make it sound alive. That's why young black guys sometimes sound as stiff or corny as middle-aged white Dixielanders. Marcellus is developing nicely as a composer. Imitating Duke Ellington isn't easy, and he's learned a lot doing it. Winton would be easy to like if he weren't so intolerant. His antipathy toward jazz's progressive wing isn't just hysterical. It's starting to look hypocritical.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz critic and record annotator in New York. He reviewed City Movement by Winton Marcellus. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis and Joyce Lieberman. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the power struggle in Russia. We talk with Soviet expert William Taubman. Also, we talk with writer Olga Carlisle about her return to Russia. She was banned from the Soviet Union because of her work with dissident writers. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.